the frequent flyer tax has been proposed. From a justice point of view, it would be very good, because you may have seen a paper by colleagues that 1% of frequent flyers produce half of the emissions, you know, and only 4% of the world population fly internationally. So it's highly, highly unequally distributed. So you could, but I'm told by experts, you know, I'm not a tax implementation expert, it would be incredibly difficult to administer. It requires some thought.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Dr. Suzanne Becken. Dr. Suzanne Becken is a professor of sustainable tourism at Griffith University in Australia, though she lives in New Zealand. She became famous recently when a paper she co-authored went viral in the travel circles because it talked about the large amount of resources and renewable energy that will be required for aviation biofuels and e-fuels. We dive right into that discussion. In fact, she's even quoted in our new book, Sustainability in the Air. I hope you enjoy this conversation with an academic and not necessarily a practitioner. Dr. Suzanne Becken doesn't shy away from the tough questions. Suzanne, welcome to the show. I wonder if we could start by you telling us a bit about yourself and your career and what exactly took you to Australia and New Zealand from Germany.
Yes, well, thank you, Shashank. Thanks for having me. So I'm a professor of sustainable tourism. I'm currently in Germany because you can probably hear from my accent that I am German. I work at Griffith University in Australia and I live in New Zealand. So I'm a little bit of a global citizen. So airlines are very close to my heart personally as well. That's why I'm so keen to contribute to making them more sustainable. But luckily we do have very good online technology these days that I could, you know, a lot of the work can be done with video calls, especially when you have global projects. And during the pandemic, we have all become masters in it. So I can enjoy New Zealand while doing my job all around the world.
You know, it's something I can relate to because Simply Flying is also 100% remote. I moved myself to Whistler, BC during the pandemic. It was fantastic living up in the mountains, and I now live in London. So It's amazing what flexibility of location can give us. And today we are, you're in Munich and I'm in London. So at least we're in similar time zones.
That's right. And a lot has changed in the last few years, hasn't it?
Right. Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think a lot of those changes are for good. I don't think we're going to see a difference. You're, of course, the professor of sustainable tourism. And among other things, you track how climate change will impact travel. Given the record temperature and the wildfires we saw in many tourist hotspots in the summer, what differences might we see in 5 years' time?
Yeah, this summer, I mean, this whole year has been a year of climate records, really. And I think most people, even just watching the news, it's hard to deny that climate change has been accelerating. More so, actually, when I started this research 20, 25 years ago, we always talked about the end of the century. You know, all the climate models were like 2100. And it was like, oh, it's so abstract, people can't imagine it. Of course, now we can imagine it because we see it. Some people get caught up, whether it's fires or heat waves or extreme flooding events. And it has affected tourism because often tourism happens in places that are, you know, natural environments, coastal areas, they are exposed. We also tend to go during the hot time of the year because especially people from, I guess, northern countries like myself, we look for the sunshine and the heat, and all of a sudden we get a lot of it. And it really is changing a little bit how people think about holidays. Shoulder seasons are becoming more popular. you know, and in some ways that's a good thing, that tourism spreads out, but a lot of people are still caught to, you know, school holiday schedules, and all of a sudden we have these extreme situations where it's not only a matter of maybe being a bit uncomfortable, but real safety concerns for some people. So I do think tourism is changing, and it will involve everyone to also think a little bit more about the risk, including the businesses that operate.
So this is very interesting. We are all feeling the effects. Primarily, I have had guests on the show who focus on sustainable aviation. You know, what can we do to decarbonize aviation? But it is a reality that you can't take a flight. Very few people take only a flight. They then rent a car, they book a hotel, they go local sightseeing. And you are a professor of sustainable travel, not sustainable aviation, which is, I think, rare yet very interesting.
Yes.
How do you think sustainable travel is different from the sustainable aviation?
Well, it is a very good question because, of course, aviation has become absolute central to tourism. And you can track that in the global tourism statistics that the arrival share by air has increased every year. So people tend to fly more. But of course, in reality, a lot of tourism is also still by car and train and bus and a bit closer. So we almost have to think that aviation is the biggest challenge for the tourism sector in terms of climate change when we talk about decarbonizing. On the other hand, tourism will not stop. You know, there could be a case to be made, and we may touch on it a bit more later, where you could say you could decouple tourism again from aviation. I mean, a lot of us in the pandemic also traveled closer to home. You know, we took even, you know, bicycle tourism, zero carbon, you know, so tourism doesn't have to stop. A lot of parts of tourism can decarbonize. Aviation is the challenge. And so it's a certain type of tourism that where this comes together. We say, okay, if we want to fly to long haul places, you know, or you want to be fast, you go somewhere for a conference or a wedding or so, which you can only do by plane. So that's the type of tourism where we have a challenge. But there's a lot of, in fact, in New Zealand, during the 2 years where our country was literally closed, many operators had the best time ever because all the New Zealanders, they couldn't go anywhere and they did all the things and they spent all the money. And the operators were actually very, very happy. So it's not so simple.
Yeah, it was local tourism, right? People were exploring their own backyard. It's what we did in Canada as well. For the first time, I think the US border was closed in years. And all Canadians were stuck at home. And there was a lot of backyard to explore there. Now, focusing on aviation, you recently co-authored a paper about the large amount of resources and renewable energy that will be required for aviation biofuels and e-fuels. I wonder if you could give our audience an overview of what were the key findings from this paper.
Yes, it was quite a challenge, that paper. And it's been sort of ruminating in my head for a few years, actually, because of course we're quite excited about the prospect of sustainable aviation fuel and replacing kerosene. But I kept thinking, what's the physics of this? You know, we have a very fantastic energy source, fossil fuel. It's got a high density. It's reasonably cheap to get out of the ground. And all of a sudden we want to run planes, which need really high density of energy on something that's renewable, whether it comes from biomass, which ultimately is the sun, or whether it's electricity for wind, whatever. And so how does that actually work? How can we replace all this? And so we started doing a bit the maths, and I brought in my colleagues, Professor David Lee from Manchester and Brendan Mackey from Griffith University as well. And we took a year to really look at sort of the prominent aviation route maps, effectively for net zero 2050. What they propose, what they claim, what their assumptions are, and how this will add up from, I guess, the physics of thermodynamics, like how much energy do we even need to make this energy, you know, and how much do we lose in the process, especially for synthetic fuel? How much feedstock is there? And then really importantly, how does this interact with other sectors? It's one thing to say, hey, we need to decarbonize aviation and we throw everything we have at the sector, you know, which is an option, or to say, well, aviation is one of many. And, you know, we've got health system, education system, other transport, you name it. We've got a whole bunch of hard to abate sectors other than aviation. So how does that all work at the same time at a short period of time? So this is effectively what the paper is about. We give some numbers of if we were to meet all these roadmaps that the aviation industry typically proposes, what share of energy would aviation require? And it's quite high. So it would be 30% of biomass by 2050, about 9% of all renewable electricity, and also 30% of green hydrogen, which we need as well as an input. So it would be substantial. My view then, like we concluded, that while SAF is a important way forward, especially for long-haul flights, I guess the message we like to send to stakeholders, don't be too sure that you would get all the volume that you want. I mean, there's a wish list, but there will be a challenge. So we start thinking about, okay, what other forms of mobility, or how would aviation work if we had a bit less SAF than we actually want to? That kind of thinking is really there. But I think as a precautionary principle, we did want to sow the seed effectively based on the science to say, okay, you just have to think about those options as well.
That is very interesting. You're talking about aviation potentially taking an unfair share of resources to get to clean SAF. Interestingly, when I speak with airline CEOs, airport CEOs, aviation executives in general, SAF is the silver bullet, it seems, in the short term, because the reality is that today there are 29,000 airplanes in the air. In 2050, there'll be 42,000 airplanes in the air. Most of them, almost all of them, will be using today's technology. And the only way that aviation can get to net zero in 2050 is by using sustainable aviation fuel that needs to be as green as possible. And that means e-fuels, PTL, and not using biofuels. And your view is that may not be possible.
That's right. And look, as a CEO of an airline, it is their job to do the best for the airline. And in that case, it would also be to lobby to say, for example, we need access to those resources. And that's exactly what's happening, including in Australia, for example. There's a SAF council. Of course, they lobby the government to say we need maybe to redirect some of those resource flows. We need access to the sugarcane industry and the oilseed industry and so on. So that's their job. My job as a scientist is to maybe look twice and say, okay, there's other issues to consider. You know, we need to decarbonize our electricity first, before we can use that to make a new fuel, if you want. We need to think about questions around justice. You know, that's a whole big topic. You know, so we need to think, is it physically possible, and what's the plan B? And so I guess that's what I'm doing. How do you look? I am often asked, how could we decide what is a fair share? You know, and where would aviation sit? And I think it really depends on what criteria we apply. So what I think, or what I fear a little bit is happening, there's the criteria of whoever pays the most gets the resource. So that's market economics. And look, if aviation is important for enough people who can afford it, maybe we can, I'm sad because I'm a professor of tourism, I'm in this boat as well. The industry will get access because we are luxury good, the highest bidder pays. If we were to say we need to allocate the resources where we get the biggest climate mitigation impact, to be honest, it wouldn't be aviation. It would be the electricity sector. We would need to get rid of any coal-fired mm-hmm. power plant. Like Australia, for example, has lots of them still. Many countries have. We would use every renewable energy that we can to switch off those plants. And it's been calculated in our paper, but also the UK, the Climate Commission, they've estimated it's about a factor of 10 times better than using it for aviation. You know, so if there was some magic global power to say we need to do the best for climate, well, it would distribute it differently. And then there's, of course, justice questions in what are the human needs? Is flying a human need just as much as nutrition and so on? So it's complicated. It's a process that needs to be negotiated.
Well, I think there are lots of negotiations that are going to be happening. You're, of course, mentioned in our new book, Sustainability in the Air. And in that, you talk about potential solutions, like a hypothetical example of the use of wood chips in New Zealand. How would something like that work?
Yeah, wood chips is an interesting one because we do have a lot of them in New Zealand. There's a forestry industry, and as a result, there's wood chips. Now, of course, my co-author, Brendan Mackey, he would say any use of wood chips is not a good thing because wood, of course, has grown for, say, 30, 40 years, taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. The moment you use them, you burn it, it's gone again into the atmosphere. So he said you shouldn't even touch them, bury them, because they are a form of carbon sequestration. They're carbon sink. So you put them away. Now, if you decide, okay, we don't do this, we use them, then comes this question, okay, what do we use them for? And one of the sort of, I guess, contenders are, you know, we've got a milk industry. They have boilers. They use coal. They want the wood chip. They could decarbonize the milk industry. And so it's the same. This is just a New Zealand example. It will be the same situation in every country where all of a sudden you have multiple industries saying we need this feedstock for our carbon roadmap. You know, there's an agricultural decarbonization roadmap, just like there is one for aviation. And then comes back to the question we just discussed. Is the government intervening to say maybe we need to allocate? And in the case of island states, there is a very good argument to be made for national connectivity and even national security. You could say we need, you know, some aviation fuel capacity in the country. And I actually do advocate for that when I can, to say we need a minimum viable network, you know. And so there could well be a case for government intervention. But then it comes back again to that question on scale. How much and what's a good distribution?
Right. So there's definitely a resource crunch here, and there can be some interesting alternatives. In your view, is there any aviation net zero roadmap that doesn't include an element of demand management? Because there's, you know, that is a critical concern for airlines, reducing demand or managing demand through frequent flyer taxes or flight caps. Are there measures that can work without this?
Well, the interesting thing is that almost all roadmaps at this point try to avoid any form of demand management. It is really, they seem to be designed to say, okay, this is the growth rate that we expect or that we want. And then maybe there's a scenario, let's just say 2% growth, 3%, 4%. And hence, that's the amount of fuel we need. And so that comes back to the point I made earlier, just reality check, what if not? But there's very few. In fact, there's the International Energy Agency Net Zero one that actually builds in specifically like, okay, let's keep certain types of travel at 2019 levels. There's the one from the ICCT, the International Council on Clean Transportation. They have specifically some measures on shift to rail. It's a minority. Of course, you could say any sort of new fuel will probably become more costly, mm-hmm. and that will be reflected in price. So there will be some inbuilt demand. But at this point, it's not really, it's of course, the airline industry at this point is not saying, hey, let's just keep it steady state and be happy with what we get. Governments are also at this point not implementing much in terms of carbon taxes on flying. There's reasons for that. The frequent flyer tax has been proposed. From a justice point of view, it would be very good because you may have seen a paper by colleagues that 1% of frequent flyers produce half of the emissions, you know, and only 4% of the world population fly internationally. So it's highly, highly unequally distributed. So you could, but I'm told by experts, you know, I'm not a tax implementation expert, it would be incredibly difficult to administer. It requires some thought.
Yeah, I think this is something we discuss in our book as well, that taxes, yes, are very difficult to administer, but the airline industry in the past has managed to implement a security fee in every ticket after 9/11, for example. In the UK, there is the airport departure tax that comes into play on every flight out of most of the UK, exiting, which goes directly into government coffers. In fact, if all the tax that the UK collects on departing flights is pooled together, that can pay for all the SAF that's needed in the UK today. So there are ways in which I think airline passengers, especially international airline passengers, have been milked by governments in driving up their own revenues. And I think we just have to think creatively, perhaps a Fly Green fund or a Clean Skies fund, where the tax or this levy is locked away and invested in green initiatives or for buying SAF, is something that we need to look at rather than just a traditional frequent flyer tax, which, yes, is hard to implement and will be extremely unpopular with the airlines and consumers as well.
Look, I 100% agree with you. We've got a proposal on the table in New Zealand around a departure tax. Whether that will ever see the light of the day or not, I don't know. It's been proposed with distance classes. It is totally implementable. And the main reason for the tax was exactly what you say, to create a fund that will help the country establish some sustainable aviation fuel, plant and achieve that kind of level of self-sufficiency in terms of fuel. So I think in the moment, maybe I'm just hypothesizing that for the airline industry, the problem is not burning enough. So we've got a lot of help. We've got a lot of technical progress, but to really say, okay, we need to self-regulate here. We need to advocate for this levy, because we need, there's a figure, I mean, there's some estimates, but let's say we need $1.5 trillion for this transition. I mean, and there's only one way to create it now while we can and charge, and then we need to do this. It's a very difficult problem, of course, with these types of common problems where someone needs to do the first step, and the moment everyone sits back, and maybe governments should do it, or maybe the airline industry as a whole. But I agree that it needs to be financed somehow. Otherwise, we will not get off the track with the change.
Right. Well, what gives me hope is that the incoming Prime Minister of New Zealand is the former CEO of Air New Zealand. So I'm sure he's familiar with the aviation sector and how to implement taxes and charges.
That's right, and he knows about it. If he ever will listen to this podcast, I can encourage him. He knows. He understands the issues for sure. And then it's a political environment.
The interesting thing is, in my first book, Soar, he was the CEO of Air New Zealand when I wrote the chapter on the entire airline. So I will actually send him a copy of this podcast. How's that?
I think he'll be delighted.
I think we will all be delighted. So let's work on that. One of the challenges, though, is governments typically make policies that are popular and not unpopular. So if you go to a country like the Netherlands, where there is significant climate awareness, the government is listening to customers and doing things like flight caps or airport caps. And there are lawsuits being brought up by climate activists. But in a place like New Zealand, which is heavily dependent on tourism, pure New Zealand, I believe, 100% pure New Zealand has been their motto for years. They have been previous tourism ministers who have gone on to become prime ministers in countries like New Zealand. You mentioned island countries, which are often dependent. How do countries like that deal with this dilemma? On one hand, there is economic certainty and stability and growth, tourism revenues. On the other hand, there is the sustainability argument. Since we are talking about New Zealand, 100% pure, will it continue to remain 100% pure if it meets or exceeds its tourism targets?
That's right. And I do think, though, it is a time for leadership, and governments maybe sometimes underestimate how much, citizens are willing to contribute. Now, when you do, global climate surveys, people are concerned. It comes up always amongst the top issues. Of course, now you have cost of living crisis, inflation. So that's acute problems. But climate change, people are very aware. We had major weather events this year in New Zealand that will cost the economy billions of dollars, billions. And so that's sometimes the idea that, well, it's a trade-off now, but if we don't do it, we will be even worse off, you know, long term. You know, so I think people are not completely stupid. They can be explained to say, okay, this is an important measure. And this is why I say the minimum viable network. We need to make sure also New Zealanders can go overseas. But does it have to be, you know, 8 times a year as some frequent flyers? It is largely a problem of frequent flyers. You know, it's not the one person that goes once a year somewhere. So I think leadership, consistency, because what we see in the moment is quite an interesting phenomenon, especially in Europe, where people are aware. We had the whole flight shame phenomenon. People know, but there's a lot of traffic. The airports are busy. You know, the 6th of July globally was the busiest air travel day ever. So people are flying. And I think people are flying because we still can. You know, I flew from New Zealand to Germany. I still can. I feel very guilty about it, but I can. And the system still in some ways promotes it. So I think consistency across, you know, whether it's politicians, even leadership, people who are in leading positions who switch, for example, to teleconferencing and send signals to say, okay, flying, yes, it's important, but it's also a highly valued activity. It's a scarce resource that we want to choose wisely, you know, to maximize the benefits. So I think we need to all sing from the same song sheet. People they are in the now.
So let's dive a little deeper into that. Yes, people like to say that they are climate conscious or climate aware, but there is a say-do gap. For example, lots of airlines have now started putting carbon offsetting mechanisms options in their booking path. So when you're booking a flight, you can choose to say, oh, please offset my flight carbon footprint using SAF or using high quality carbon offsets. But the percentage of people clicking to pay for that is anywhere from 0.1% to 3% of all flyers. So, and this is in climate aware countries like Northern Europe. And, you know, we can forget about countries, high growth markets where people are flying for the first time and still sorting by price. So how do we account for the say-do gap? Yes, people are saying things, but their actions are not really speaking much louder.
That's right. And it is complex. Obviously, it's a general human phenomenon, isn't it? We all make good resolutions in the beginning of the year and, you know, we say these things and then we might do something else. So that's one thing. A second one is, and by the way, the more people make public commitments, research shows that public commitments are much more adhered to. This is why these pledges, you know, you can be cynical about climate pledges, but they carry at least a weight that someone then can't quite easily step back. So that's important. The systems need to be improved to make it easier. For example, I try to travel by rail in Europe now across multiple countries. It actually takes quite a bit of determination to get a ticket as opposed to just buy an airfare, which is much easier. The systems, we have put so much effort into this, the global airline industry, to make it very convenient for the customer, and including corporate, like our Griffith University corporate agent, they, when you ask for a rail ticket, they struggle. They're not geared up for it. So there's little things like that where I think we need to make it easier. And then the incentive. So last week I was at a conference in Austria, which was a hybrid conference. And at the end, there was a best paper award, one for presence and one for an online participant. And I was really pleased because basically, if you just presented online, you still, you know, you had, in fact, then a higher chance to get the best paper because there were fewer. But these things are really important, that people don't feel if I don't fly there, you know, I can't do certain things. So these incentives to reward that type of behavior are important.
I'm glad to hear. Did you win that award?
No, I didn't put any. in fact, if you really want to know, I gave the opening address and the title was Confronting Climate Breakdown and Human Stupidity. But that's a whole different topic.
All right. Earlier in the season, I had the CEO of Red Sea Global, John Pagano, on this show. Something struck out to me because he was the first ever executive who spoke about implementing, not just conceptually, but implementing an ecological ceiling at Red Sea Global of 1 million visitors a year. Do you see merit in other destinations when you look at end-to-end travel doing the same? Say, we take X number of visitors per year and no more. Are there examples of others doing this? Is this scalable?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean, the notion of carrying capacity is actually getting a bit of a revival in many destinations. And I think it's a combination of social pressure. I mean, think Amsterdam, think Venice, and we have places in New Zealand. So carrying capacity, ecological ceilings. Like, you know, think about, I don't know if you had already someone in your show on international aviation policy. If these international flights finally become part of national accounting, which is being discussed. So in the moment, of course, they are, you know, under the mandate of ICAO, but the moment they sit on every country's carbon budget, it'll be a problem for some countries. It will add significantly. And so all of a sudden you have to think, well, actually, how much do we want of this? And do we put a ceiling? So I think it's very important to think about ceilings. It may also lead to improvements of the experience and the product. Because frankly, in the last decades, we have absolutely gone for conveyor belt mass tourism. You know, the margins, and especially in the airline industry, have become smaller and smaller. You know, and in, you know, the, I guess the mass tourism model really sort of thrived on volume and not value. Now, it's easily said, in most destinations, of course, would love to switch to value. But I think we really need to think hard about that, how we improve the experience and how simultaneously we can reduce the need to churn for as many people as possible. And I think overall it will be a better experience. It comes back to what I said earlier, that it's maybe a scarce, you know, in the good old days, you had one holiday a year. You probably didn't even fly, but it was super special. You looked forward to it. You prepared you afterwards. You thought about it. Now it's just like bang, bang, bang. It's just constant. And so maybe that will help. And putting some of these ceilings on place is probably also fair to the local population and environment. So look, I think it's an idea worth supporting.
Right. Ideas worth supporting. Maybe you should start a, you know, something competing with TED instead of ideas worth spreading, ideas worth supporting, especially in tourism. I love the mention around value versus volume. And yes, it was volume. I remember going to Paris a few years ago and going to the Louvre, and every single person wanted to take a selfie with the Mona Lisa. The only thing was there were about 500 tourists in the selfie as well, along with Mona Lisa. And it was really hard in the summer. Value tourism. Can you think of examples of countries, cities, destinations that are doing well in this regard, which are doing value tourism well?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, there's your classic examples like Bhutan, you know, and there's specific circumstances in that they're quite highly controlled tourism sector where you can only fly with the airline and only stay and so on. So I'm not saying everyone should go like Bhutan, but it is one example where they, you know, they limit the numbers they charge reasonably high sort of sustainability fee, like an entry fee. So there's that. Other countries.
It's interesting you mentioned Bhutan. I just want to take you up on that, because Bhutan this year reduced their entry fee because they had increased their entry fee after COVID. The number of tourists dropped so significantly that they've decided to lower their fee. It seems like, yes, they are going for value, but they also want a minimum volume as well. That's so it seems like even Bhutan has buckled.
Even Bhutan, that's right, because it just shows you you know, the hopes for tourism as poverty alleviation tool, and that is the balance. I mean, Vanuatu in the Pacific Islands would be another example where they really try to ensure that tourism is an outcome for the local well-being. But even there, again, you will have these situations where you have cruise ships, increasingly large cruise ships pushing in, which might undermine well-being. So it just, I guess, eyes wide open when you are in these positions where you can influence tourism in a country. Yes, you want to reap the benefits, but you also don't want to create dependencies and ecological damage that will backfire. So yes, it's a balance. But I think what we've seen before the pandemic, when the thresholds are exceeded, You will now for sure, because there's a point where even the local people just don't take it anymore.
Right. Since you're talking about the Pacific Islands, a good example that comes to mind is Fiji. I had the CEO of Fiji Airways on the show, and he told me something very interesting. They're thinking about it like an Iceland Air model with a stopover program, but the stopover program is around conservation. So on the flight, you learn about Sabu the turtle, the sea turtle, and then you can go land, and during the stopover, you can go plant mangroves, you can visit the turtle sanctuary, and in the end, you can plant enough mangroves or do enough conservation efforts on your stopover that you take care of your carbon footprint from the flight itself, which I thought was a very creative manner of addressing this.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, this whole idea of regenerative tourism, which has got traction, and especially in the Pacific Islands, because it also fits the cultural, the worldview of us being one with nature and tourism, not just coming and taking, but actually giving back, and I think that has great potential. We still need to decarbonize the flight, of course, but I think the shift in thinking a little bit, what can tourism do for the country? Not just we're here to serve tourism. I think that's a big shift, and we can, many visitors are very keen and willing to engage in those things.
Right. I usually love to end with this question. What gives you the most hope about the future of sustainable travel?
the biggest hope is maybe the many little initiatives and the enthusiasm, including like yourself here on the podcast, people who actually truly try with a passion. And there is actually a lot. If I had endless hours of time, I would love to map them on a world map, because there is a lot of, innovation, drive, tipping the system with that grassroots, activities of showing a better model. I mean, that does give me hope.
Well, I'm hopeful too. The fact that these conversations are going beyond just airlines to airports and now travel end to end, I think that's something we have to think about, because it's not just about flying. It's about end to end travel. And I'm glad we've had this conversation. I'm quite hopeful. I'm more hopeful after speaking with you than I thought I would be at the beginning of this conversation. So I think that's good a good thing.
Well, that's great.
That's a good thing. Now, the final part of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round, in which we get to know you a bit more personally, especially in your case, your students and fellow academics who may not have known about you. So I'm going to ask you simple, short questions, and you can give me one-line answers or one-word answers. And we'll start something simple with what's your favorite book?
I think my favorite book is Homo Sapiens from Harari, Israel philosopher, because it's just fascinating to read about the whole history of where we came from, and really interesting read. I read it a couple of times now.
Yeah, it's very, very fascinating. Harari is one of my favorite authors as well, and I enjoyed Sapiens even more than Homo Deus, and then the 21 things that he came up with afterwards. Yeah. It was original work, truly original work. What's your favorite movie?
Oh, movie. Well, oh gosh, there's so many. Maybe because my head is in aviation, I do like the Catch Me If You Can with Leonardo DiCaprio. Yep.
I love it. Yes. Yeah, you love That's it. A good one. Indeed. Oh, wow. Brought back really nice memories. It's been a while since I watched it. Perhaps it's time to revisit it now. So that's a good one. What's your favorite airline?
Oh, there's only one for me, and that's Air New Zealand.
Okay, fantastic. I am going to send you a copy of my original book, Soar, because there's a full chapter on Air New Zealand and their turnaround. So I agree. I have enjoyed Air New Zealand as well. What's your favorite city?
Oh, there's so many wonderful cities. I may have to say Munich. They call Munich the biggest village in the world. It's got this Bavarian sort of smallness, but it's still a pretty cool city.
Are you from Munich?
Yeah, just a little bit outside.
Okay, very interesting. What is something you want to learn?
I think I want to relearn my French. I've just come from Paris from some meetings, and it's all very dormant in my head. So if I can relearn that, that would be fantastic.
Okay, that language is always up there. What do you do in your free time?
I try to do a bit of exercise if I get the chance. It's a good balance.
Okay. Outdoors or indoors?
outdoors.
Okay. What's the best advice you ever received?
The best advice I got from my PhD supervisor 20 years ago, and he always said, you can't win a game by watching the ball on the foot of the opposition. So basically, focus on your game. Don't worry what X or Y are doing, just focus and do it. And I think that is very, very true.
Wow, that's good advice. And I agree with it. You said Air New Zealand is your favorite airline. You live in New Zealand. You are right now in Munich. On your next flight from Munich to New Zealand, which I believe will be at least 18 hours, who would you like to be seated next to? This can be a person living or not alive.
Well, actually, funnily enough, last time when I flew from the, I was at the COP in Egypt, and I actually sat across the corridor from El Gore. But the whole flight, I didn't dare to, and he was kind of, I think he had enough talking to people. But if I was really stuck with him for 12 hours or 18 hours, and I would get a chance to talk to him, I would love
wow.
to.
Okay, Al Gore it is. Hopefully you will see him for COP28 as well, despite his rather fiery speech recently for TED.
Yes, I know.
If we are to speak a year from now and we are popping champagne, what are we celebrating?
I think we would celebrate that we truly, truly take the climate crisis serious, and the urgency. I mean, there's lots of nice stuff happening, but I go with Greta Thunberg on that one. If the house is on fire, act like the house is on fire. So that's what I want to see.
I think let's pause on the celebratory note. And hopefully, we have answered some tough questions on this podcast and given lots of food for thought. Dr. Becken, I really appreciate your time today, and thank you so much for doing the work that you are doing, and I wish you a really good flight from Munich to New Zealand whenever you're coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries, yet there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying, that's simply with an i.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website green.simplifying.com and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simplifying. The show is produced by Juraj Toth in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our director of sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.